It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we have with us Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ben.
Valerie Hennings is with us. It's been a while since Valerie's been on. We're sure glad to have her on our program, associate professor of political science at Morningside College in Sioux City. Valerie, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
We're devoting the entire hour of this Politics Day to analysis of Iowa's congressional primaries. Next Tuesday, June 2nd, the primary to decide who will face four incumbent members of Congress from Iowa, who will battle for that open seat in Iowa's 2nd District following the retirement of U.S. Representative Dave Loebsack. Perhaps you're watching or participating in one of these primary races. Join our conversation this hour, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100 or river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Perhaps you're going to vote on Tuesday, or perhaps you've mailed in your ballot this year because of the COVID crisis. Valerie, I think we're going to deal with the 4th District. Very interesting, unusual Republican primary going on there. But first of all, let's go to the statewide Senate primary there. The Democrats need a win of, I guess, a net of 3 seats, if my math is serving me right, to tie the Senate, 4 seats to take it outright. And Senator Joni Ernst's seat has become a major target for Democrats in this year's elections. Chris, comment on this. Last year at this time, roughly at this time, Senator Ernst was not seen as terribly vulnerable. Well, why has that changed to make the Democrats see a chance here?
I think it's changed in large part due just to the atmospheric surrounding the election. We know that for U.S. Senate races, these typically become nationalized in the sense they get caught up in the conversation around national campaigns. And in 2020, we're talking about a presidential election. Mm-hmm. And over the years, we've seen a closer and closer tie between what happens in Senate races and what happens in presidential races at the statewide level. And so as that correlation has become stronger. And so what that means for Senator Ernst is she's obviously a Republican, but she shares party affiliation with the president, and the president's approval rating has not been that great. You know, there hasn't been a lot of movement over his tenure in office, but it's, you know, roughly low to mid 40s. And as more controversy surrounds the president, particularly his response to the COVID-19 pandemic, mm-hmm. you know, there's a concern, I think, among Republicans that if voters are going to the polls and thinking about the Republican Party and thinking about President Trump and thinking about his response to the pandemic, if there's any sort of disapproval there or any sort of wavering, that potentially spells trouble for Republicans down ballot. And then, of course, when you're talking about presidential election year, you're also talking about perceptions of the economy and the old question about is the country on the right track or the wrong track. Just looking this morning on the polling averages from Real Clear Politics, there's a gap of about 27 points. That is about on average, if you look on average of most polls, 59% of Americans say the country is on the wrong track compared to 32% who say it's on the right track. And so you have a president who has sub 50 approval ratings. You have a majority of Americans who say the country is on the wrong track. There's obviously, you know, severe economic difficulties going on within the country, whether you're talking about unemployment rates or a number of other economic factors. And so all of that potentially spells trouble for Republican candidates down ballot, because if voters are going to the poll, again, not really separating out individual candidates from the president, but rather just voting based on perceptions of the party, that's going to make it difficult for Senator Ernst, in addition to the fact that this is her first reelection bid. And mm-hmm. typically for incumbents, your first reelection bid is the most difficult.
Valerie Hennings given the landscape that Chris laid out there, how it's turned against Republicans in recent months, according to polling, and because of the COVID crisis, the effect on the economy, are you seeing? Well, Senator Ernst recently did a tele-town hall with Team Trump, a visit to Iowa a couple of weeks ago. This was the first trip outside of Washington for Vice President Pence. So how do you see Senator Ernst defining her work in relation to the Trump administration?
Well, I think in many ways, the context that we are in right now is unlike many other contexts. So the fact that we see our candidates, including Senator Ernst, participating in these tele-virtual town hall meetings is particularly important to look at how she is choosing to connect to the president. As Chris said, when we are heading into a presidential election, those candidates who share the same party affiliation as the individual holding the presidency, they can meet an advantage as well as see a disadvantage. And I think Senator Ernst is something what she is working to do is to walk that very fine line when it comes to not only the primary elections, but also heading towards that general election and who she's ultimately going to be facing in November.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to know some of the Democratic candidates vying to face Senator Ernst in the November election. Michael Franken is one of those, a retired Navy Vice Admiral. Here's a little bit of an ad of his, an introductory ad from several months ago. In it, Franken highlighted his military experience. He tells the story at the start of this ad of representing the Navy in Pentagon negotiations surrounding the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and being the lone dissenting voice standing against that invasion. Let's listen.
I wasn't surprised that everyone else in the room did the White House's bidding, but like millions of other Americans, I was disappointed when Congress fell in line too.
The joint resolution is passed.
I'm Michael Franken, and I'm running for the U.S. Senate because today, Washington is even worse. The Republicans are afraid to ever stand up to Donald Trump, and D.C. Democrats aren't bold enough to confront the climate crisis, the healthcare industry, and Wall Street. Join me. Because now more than ever, Iowans need a senator who will go against the grain in Washington to do what's right for Iowa.
So back to you again, Valerie, a retired Navy Vice Admiral who shows here early on, this is an older ad, but that he was against what has proven to be a disastrous intervention overseas.
And I think this particular message from Franken is spot on as he heads into the primaries against his Democratic contenders, highlighting that particular experience, not only from his military background, but that actual choice and where he stood when it came to previous decisions. I think he's also considering when it comes to if he ultimately receives the nomination, what are some of the things that are going to speak to Iowans when it comes to their choice between Senator Ernst and possibly himself. That mm-hmm. military background, that potential to really genuinely understand foreign international relations and how that can affect Iowa and the nation overall, I do think is something that individuals are thinking about when it comes to how we're being represented in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Chris, comment on this. Michael Franken grew up in Sioux County, a retired vice admiral in the U.S. Navy, 37 years of military service. Of course, when you serve in the military, in the Navy especially, you don't spend a lot of time in Iowa, but recently receiving the endorsement from the Des Moines Register. Comment on his candidacy here.
Well, I would agree with what Valerie has said. And, you know, I think for the Franken campaign, what he's looking at is to try to take advantage of, you know, ironically, similar to what Joni Ernst did back in 2014 in terms of talking about your military background as a strength, and that will help you when you get to Washington, D.C., because all these candidates are running as everybody runs as a Washington outsider, that somehow you can go to Washington, D.C. and fix what's going on. We saw Joni Ernst do this in 2014, and you heard it in that ad from Michael Franken now, is that the military background, you know, he's running on the idea that military background, he has a set of traits, and he's going to be strong enough to stand up with, as he said, stand up with what's going on in Washington, D.C., and that the military background is something that is seen as an advantage for Senator Ernst. And I think for people who are looking at the Franken campaign and potentially supporting the Franken campaign, they also see that as something that's going to put him out more on a level playing ground with Senator Ernst, and that they both have that military background in addition to representing Iowa and Washington, D.C.
If you just joined us, two political scientists on this Politics Wednesday, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Valerie Hennings of Morningside College in Sioux City. This half hour, we're looking at the Democratic Senate candidates vying to face Joni Ernst in the November election. Let's move to Kimberly Graham, an advocate and attorney for children in juvenile court. In a recent ad, Kimberly Graham calls out the influence of corporate money in politics. Images in this ad illustrating corporate and dark money funding behind Senator Joni Ernst and Graham's competitor, Teresa Greenfield. Let's listen.
As someone who's been a single mom since my son was 7 years old and trying to pay everything on my own, as someone still in debt from my education who has put off going to the doctor, I understand better than the other candidates running for this office what it is like to try to make it financially in 2020 as a working person to not ever be able to get substantially ahead. Until we get more people like me and you into positions of power, none of this is going to change. We can transform Iowa.
A recent ad by Senate candidate Kimberly Graham. Chris, how do you see Kimberly Graham positioning herself in this primary?
Well, I mean, she's touching on, again, a very common theme that we see in congressional races, in the sense of saying that the candidate is one of us, that is a everyday Iowan. And she talks about, you know, calling out big money in politics, which, of course, you know, is universally accepted that most people are against more money into politics. I think, you know, but again, for Kimberly Graham, this is going to be a challenge. And as we go through these other candidates, the challenge is going to be raising money and competing with Senator Ernst, but also raising money and just getting through this primary. Because if you look at the fundraising numbers for this primary race for the four Democrats, and I know we'll get to Teresa Greenfield here in a minute, but
yep.
Kimberly Graham, Michael Franken are considerably behind the fundraising numbers for Teresa Greenfield. I mean, if you look at opensecrets.org, they have their latest numbers up there pulled up from May 13th of this year. And cash on hand for Kimberly Graham is just over $33,000. For Michael Franken, it's over $49,000. And then you look up for Teresa Greenfield, and she's at $4.7 million. Mm. I mean, that's going to be incredibly difficult to compete with. I mean, obviously money isn't everything, but you need money to have a strong organization, and you need money to put out ads, door knock, and make sure that you're mobilizing people to vote. I think the difference this year, though, is, you know, as we'll talk about, just the process of voting, because there's so much more voting in so many more absentee requests.
Right.
How does that change turnout going into the primary next week?
Mm-hmm. Valerie, I want to get to Teresa Greenfield in just a moment, but let's keep on Kimberly Graham in just a moment. At the moment, talk a little bit about how you see her position here, her issues, her appeal as a candidate here.
In many ways, when I think about her campaign and the challenge that she has before her, as Chris is talking about, absolutely the fundraising piece is a critical aspect. In order just to make it through this primary process, the fact that she, her competitors, her Democratic competitors, are out fundraising her is going to be a critical piece. Although she is focusing on and trying to emphasize how not only Senator Ernst, but also some of her opponents within the Democratic Party are being supported by outside money, money still does matter. Mm-hmm. So that's playing a key role not only in this race, but also the House races that we're seeing in Iowa as well. Something that I think she is doing well in many ways, but I think can sometimes be almost viewed as campaigns 101. And in part, Chris touched on this as well with trying to make that connection. What Kimberly Graham is trying to do right now, as our other candidates, is that name recognition for such a statewide office. So trying to make that connection as a working person, trying to connect with her fellow Iowans, I think is an important piece that she's doing right. And particularly in the time of COVID-19, I think that may resonate in ways that we haven't seen in the past.
Join our conversation as we discuss the primary candidates, in this case, the Democratic primary candidates. But we'll be talking about the House races a little bit later in the hour. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Perhaps you want to mention something or ask our political scientists about something that has caught your eye or your ear. Well, let's talk about Teresa Greenfield. Let's start off by hearing a part of her ad or one of her ads. On Tuesday, Teresa Greenfield released her latest campaign video. This is her own take on Senator Joni Ernst's famous squeal ad from 2014.
Listen, folks, Joni Ernst said she'd be different.
Washington's full of big spenders. Let's make them squeal.
Well, she didn't castrate anyone. She cast her votes to let the corporate lobbyists keep feasting like hogs at the trough. You want to really make them squeal? Ban corporate PAC money. Take away their loopholes and special tax breaks. Give the breaks to working folks instead. I'm Teresa Greenfield, and I approve this message because it's time Washington worked for you.
Okay, there, Chris. Teresa Greenfield giving Senator Ernst a dose of what she gave her opponent in 2014, right?
Yeah, really playing off one of the probably most...
Chris, are you there? Well, I think we lost Chris. Valerie, jump in there to comment on Teresa Greenfield.
Absolutely. So one thing that we are seeing with Teresa is that she is certainly outraising her fellow competitors, as well as gearing up and establishing that ground support that you would need in a statewide Senate bid. So she is certainly making sure that she has all those pieces in place. By being, in many ways, deemed kind of the front runner among her Democratic counterparts, is that it's also made her a bit of a target. We've seen this primary election switch a little bit when it comes to not only those her competitors perhaps focusing on what Senator Ernst has done, but it's also made her a target where people are questioning, for example, some of the money that is being spent on her behalf in Iowa when it comes to getting her name out and trying to garner the support that she would need in order to ultimately face Joni Ernst.
Mm-hmm. So Greenfield, a real estate developer backed by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, backed by Emily's List, 21 unions in my reading, including the AFL-CIO of Iowa. So why? How did she get to this place, this dominance in this primary race? Chris mentioned a moment ago, and he'll be back here. In a moment, how did she get to this dominant place among Democrats in this primary?
Well, I think in many ways, she's done the foundational work that is needed. She certainly has the PAC support as well as the party support. And that, as a candidate, is something that you are seeking. And if you are fortunate enough to get that support early on and those endorsements early on, it makes things so much easier. Just a few months ago, in many ways, folks thought that Teresa Greenfield was the leader, and she wasn't going to be facing much competition come next week. We're not sure if that's necessarily going to be the case, but because early on she was able to get those endorsements and establish that statewide structure when it comes to that ground support, being an early mover in that way has helped her a great deal. And we're seeing that by her leader status.
Mm-hmm. Chris Larimer has rejoined us. Sorry about that disconnection, Chris. We're still talking about Teresa Greenfield. Your comment, please.
Yeah, and I was able to listen a little bit there to what Valerie was saying, and I would certainly agree. You know, She's locked up the endorsements, as you mentioned, the Emily's List, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, Chuck Schumer, you know, not long after she announced her candidacy, coming out in support for her. And then, you know, with that has come all the money. And as I said earlier, you know, $4.7 million cash on hand. That's going to be really important if the Democrats see this as a competitive seat. This is with all the money raised so far, this is well over a $20 million race. And, you know, by all accounts, it's going to be very competitive come November. And so I think for Democrats looking at this, and this often happens with races, is it, do you vote based on principle? Do you agree with one of the other candidates more, or do you just look at it based on electability? And how do you define electability? And do you define that in terms of just an ability to win based on fundraising numbers? And again, that's where Teresa Greenfield has a considerable advantage over the other three candidates in just the amount of money, the endorsements that she has locked up at this point. And I think most people are probably at the point where they're looking at this primary race thinking, even though there are four candidates in the race, to some extent, it would still be a little bit surprising if she doesn't get to that 35% threshold next week to avoid this going to a convention.
Before we go to break, let's hear an ad from Eddie Morrow, another candidate, Senate Democratic candidate. He released an ad earlier this month focusing on his philanthropic work and his business career in Des Moines.
I get up every morning with one thought. How can we make Iowa stronger? Whether by feeding the hungry, fighting injustice, or helping small businesses grow. Iowans show up, we listen, and we get the job done. I'm Eddie Morrow, and I'm running for the U.S. Senate and approve this message because I believe in Iowa. I believe in our people. I believe in our values. And I believe, together, we can make tomorrow better than today.
Okay, the voice of Eddie Morrow. Valerie, tell us quickly about a minute for you or 45 seconds and then on to Chris before our break. Tell us about Eddie in your eyes.
I think one of the contributions that Eddie Morrow has when it comes to this particular election is that he is forcing Democrats in particular to think about who they want as their nominee. He is playing a role, as I mentioned earlier, that because Teresa Greenfield in many ways was deemed the leader in this primary race early on, he has now gone on to eventually attack her in some of the ads that he's done. And I think that, too, is shaping the overall conversation for this primary race for the Democrats heading into next week.
Mm-hmm. Chris, 30 seconds for you.
Yeah, I would agree. I think one of the contributions is just the making this race a bit more competitive than it would have. I mean, without Eddie Morrow in the race, this would be runaway for Teresa Greenfield. So it keeps it competitive going into next week's election. And obviously he's self-financed and is doing well and able to make that competitive.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. More from Chris Larimer and Valerie Hennings, our two political scientists on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Talk a little bit more about the Senate campaign in just a moment, but then we want to move on to those U.S. House primaries, particularly the interesting, unusual primary in the 4th District. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment with more Politics Wednesday. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad you're on board. Also on board are analysts, political scientists Valerie Hennings of Morningside College in Sioux City, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Before we get to that unusual 4th District primary race among Republican primary challengers to incumbent Steve King, let's have you tackle Bob's query from Ames. He's listening, and he wants some further comment. Chris, let me aim this at you. Comments on who is funding Greenfield's campaign. Teresa Greenfield, he says he understands a lot, came from the DNC, and thinks it's a problem that the DNC has singled out a certain candidate. So what's your response to Bob there? It seems that the reason you have a primary is to decide which candidate you have, but the DNC, what, jumping on board to back one candidate ahead of time is the way I'm reading Bob's comment.
Yeah, and it's a really good question, and I haven't looked into all the details of her fundraising yet. And if he's interested, like I said, a really good website that I know a lot of political scientists rely on is just opensecrets.org.
and you can look up all congressional races around the country and pull up an Excel file of all their fundraising numbers. But, you know, I think this gets back to an earlier comment in terms of how do you approach this race? I think for national Democrats, they saw this as a potential pickup early last year. And as the year has unfolded and as we're into 2020, they continue to see this as a race that's potentially a pickup seat for them. It's gone from, you know, likely Republican to lean Republican. And so there's a lot of outside money coming in because national Democrats see this as a potential pickup. And again, it gets back to that trade-off. Do you vote based on principle, you know, kind of a really objective view of all the candidates and their policy positions? Or do you look at it just in terms of electability and how competitive the candidate will be in the general election in November? And I think that's a challenge. And you see that in every race, every year, where you're trying to make that trade-off. You know, is this a candidate I agree with completely on the issues versus do I go with another candidate who maybe I agree with less but has a better chance to win in November? And so I think that's what's going on with a little bit with Teresa Greenfield, is that national Democrats have come in and said, we want to identify early who our candidate is going to be so that mm-hmm. candidate can be more competitive for November.
Mm-hmm. Valerie, let's switch over to the 4th District primary over there where you are in Sioux City. This is where the GOP primary is receiving a lot of attention. Iowa's 4th Congressional District covers North Central and Northwest Iowa, a district that includes the cities of Ames and Sioux City. We have 9-term incumbent Representative Steve King. He has represented the Northwest Iowa in Congress since 2002. He has 4 challengers: State Senator Randy Feenstra, Irwin Mayor Brett Richards, Woodbury County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor, and businessman Steve Reeder. The winner of that primary will face the Democrat, J.D. Scholten. He's running unopposed in the Democrats' primary. We can talk a little bit about the 2018 race because that's why Scholten is there, right? But remind us here, Valerie, why does Steve King all of a sudden in this term have so many challengers?
Well, I think what makes this race so interesting and this primary race so interesting is it's a question about Steve King's service and what his Republican challengers are focusing on and doing a very fine job of highlighting is whether or not he can continue to effectively represent the 4th District of Iowa in Washington, D.C. Recently, Steve King has been stripped of his committee assignments. He has made different various remarks that people have found offensive, and there are many within the Republican Party who are concerned that he can no longer do his job. So we are seeing these Republican challengers, in particular, when it comes to kind of that leading contender among those 4 opponents. Randy Feenstra is doing quite well in his political advertising, is highlighting that competitiveness highlighting the effectiveness of Representative King. While, you know, treading carefully to not alienate the folks who have been supporting Representative King since 2002.
Mm-hmm. And we just heard recently, well, earlier this month, Chris, King had told Iowans at a debate that his committees would be put back with all of his seniority. Kevin McCarthy denied any such thing happened. So what Valerie said there is really a key point. If you have a veteran member of Congress with no committee assignments, that's a problem.
It is. It really is. And that's, as Valerie said, have been a key point for Randy Feenstra's campaign, is that in his words, quote, you know, Steve King is no longer an effective representative for Iowa because, as Valerie said, he was stripped of those committees, I think in January of 2019, of being on the House Judiciary, House Agricultural Committees, and obviously a member of the Agricultural Committee. That's extremely important for representing Iowa, in particular Western Iowa. And, you know, there's been some back and forth between McCarthy and King on what was actually said over that. But that's been a real problem for Steve King, is how can he effectively represent the district if he's not on committees in Congress? And so I think it's, you know, all of these comments have caught up to Steve King. You're seeing some endorsements come out for Andy Pienstra. I know we talked earlier in the month about, you know, the Chamber of Commerce coming out in favor of Senator Pienstra. He's obviously raised a considerable amount of money, many times over, more than what Steve King has raised in this race. And so, you know, when you look at the primary races across Iowa for the four congressional districts, this is by far the most interesting one, because you have an incumbent being challenged who is being outraised, where you have national leaders coming out against him. And, you know, we'll have to see how it plays out. There was just an article in today's New York Times about this particular primary and what's going to happen, and talking about, you know, the irony of all of it could be that with four candidates in the race, or five candidates in the race, you know, you could end up being where none of them get to 35%, which means it goes to a convention. And then if you think back, well, that's how Steve King got this position in the first place, was in 2002. He didn't win the primary outright. It went to a convention. He was selected as the nominee and then, you know, went on to serve these nine terms.
Mm-hmm. Well, very quickly, we have other House races to look at here. But very quickly, your read on the 4th District, Valerie, quickly, what do you think will happen? Do you think that vote among the opposition to King will be split and he may end up being the nominee again?
I think there is a high chance that it's possible that of all of them, as Chris said, this could be forced to convention. I think what's also interesting to watch in the next week or so is how King is choosing to respond to the challenge that folks such as Randy Pienstra are presenting to him. In many of his messaging and the way that he's trying to campaign, he is presenting this against the swamp message. And as an incumbent who's been in this particular position since 2002, I find that, you know, outsider status messaging to be fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move over to Iowa's first congressional district. It covers the northeastern part of the state, including Waterloo, Cedar Falls area, also Cedar Rapids, down to Cedar Rapids, over to Dubuque in the east. It's interesting that Donald Trump carried the first district in Iowa by 49% to 45% over Hillary Clinton in 2016. That heading into the election, this election, Democrat Abby Finkenauer, first elected in 2018, defending that seat there. GOP candidates vying to face her. Chief among them, I guess, State Representative Ashley Hinson of Marion. Chris, who else? Thomas Hansen of Decorah, also in this Republican primary. Am I missing anybody? Comment on this race.
No, those are the two candidates. And this really, and Thomas Hansen has been active in, as I understand it, Winnesee County politics. But really, if you kind of look at the endorsements, and again, you look at fundraising, and I'll just quote the fundraising numbers I have again for Ashley Hinson: cash on hand, just over $1 million versus Thomas Hansen, who has about $1,500 on cash on hand at the latest report. So I think most people see this as a primary that Ashley Hinson is going to win by a considerable margin. Should not, I think it'd be very, very shocking, I guess, if she didn't get to that 35%. But she is a candidate who, as you said, is a member of the Iowa House of Representatives, was elected in 2016 and reelected in 2018. So she does have some name recognition in the district. She is also a former TV anchor in the district. And so this is going to be a competitive race. And it really is interesting to think about, because you have Abby Finkenauer win in 2018, which was a big year for Democrats nationally as well as in Iowa. But then now we're up to 2020. And again, the race is put as a toss-up. And I think in large part for the reason you said is that this was a district that was won by Donald Trump by about 3.5 percentage points in 2016. Democrats have been making gains in the district. They've increased their proportion within the district of voters who are registered with the Democratic Party by about a percentage and a half. She's, you know, doing well in terms of fundraising, but this is, at least as of now, still a Trump district. She is one of those 30 Democrats around the country who are running for re-election in districts where voters voted for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton in 2016. So I think this is going to continue to be a competitive race. And in particular, when you think about the strength of a challenger, if you're running against someone who has elected office experience, that makes it more difficult because that challenger then knows how to win office, has some name recognition. So I think this is, once we get past next week's primary, this is going to continue to be a competitive race going forward toward November.
President Trump evidently also looking at the numbers from 2016 in the Iowa's 1st Congressional District. He weighed in on this Republican primary, endorsing State Representative Ashley Hinson of Marion. Hinson has campaigned with the president, tweeted that she was, quote, honored to have the support of at Real Donald Trump as I fight to defend Iowa families and work with him to get Americans back to work. So tapping in, trying to tap into that support, the popularity, at least as demonstrated in 2016, of Donald Trump. Let's go to Iowa's 3rd district, where former Iowa representative, U.S. Representative David Young is back for a rematch. Also unusual here in Iowa's 3rd district, he lost to Democrat Cindy Axne by 2 points in 2018. Remember, David Young, former chief of staff for Senator Charles Grassley, first elected to the 3rd district in 2014. He won re-election in 2016 by a big margin, bigger than Donald Trump won that district. So, Valerie, take us to this race. So we have, is this sort of set in stone now, more or less, in political terms? Young will be the nominee to face Axne?
I think in many ways. And what makes this race so particularly interesting is the fact that we are seeing a rematch from 2018 if Young does indeed receive that nomination. And again, when we think about, even though Axne, one of our first women sent to the U.S. House from the state of Iowa, this is still just her first term. And often that first reelection is very critical. So I think the fact that this District 3 race is considered a toss-up while we have a Democratic incumbent, I think having someone such as David Young, who has this wealth of political experience as a challenger, is what is making this particular race so competitive.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what will it take for David Young to win back the seat he once held, the 3rd District?
I think he's going to have to separate himself from any negative perception of the Republican Party. And again, that becomes very difficult. But what is working to David Young's advantage is that he does have district-wide name recognition, having held the seat. And even when you look back at the election returns in 2018, Cindy Axne, as I understand it, won only one county in the district. She won Polk County, and obviously that carries a significant weight in that particular district. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, she lost the other counties in the district. And, this is also a so-called Trump district. This is a district, again, where a Democrat is holding it. But Trump won the district in 2016 by, again, about 3.5 percentage points. So, you know, I see this as something that's going to be very competitive going forward. And if you look at, you know, congressional districts 1, 2, and 3, the balance between Democrats and Republicans is generally the tightest within this particular district. You know, a year ago, the number of Democratic and Republican registered voters was essentially tied. Democrats have now moved out in front, but he already has the name recognition. And you know, once you get outside of Polk County, it is a very much a Republican district.
Mm-hmm. Chris, would you also rate this a toss-up race? If indeed David Young is the nominee?
I would, yes, at this point, absolutely.
Okay, let's move to the only district we haven't talked about yet, the Iowa 2nd District. This is the southeast Iowa district, including Iowa City, Fairfield, Mount Pleasant, Washington, Davenport. 5 GOP candidates on the ballot in this 2nd Congressional District. We have the political veterans, Marionette Miller-Meeks, Bobby Schilling, other candidates, Tim Borchardt, Stephen Everly, Ricky Lee Phillips. Now, the winner of the Republican primary will face the Democratic challenger, former State Senator Rita Hart, in the November election. This is a seat being vacated, currently occupied by U.S. Representative Democrat Dave Loebsack of Iowa City, first elected in 2006 in that memorable beating the incumbent Jim Leach way back then, but we don't have time to go back into all that history. Valerie, tell us how you size up the GOP contenders here to evidently to face Rita Hart in the November election.
In this kind of five-person primary field, I would say that Marionette Miller-Meeks, with her experience as well as her fundraising, I think certainly is kind of the favorite at this point. I'm excited to kind of think about what this could then mean for the state of Iowa and our representation come November, because if we find that we've got two individuals, Rita Hart and Marionette Miller-Meeks, we might be sending another woman from a new district from Iowa to represent us in Washington, which I think would be yet another first. That often makes sense as an open seat where we see places where we haven't previously elected a woman or someone from another minoritized group be elected. An open seat provides an opportunity, and I think that District 2 provides that this year for our state.
We have to remember District 2, do we not, Chris? And I know you keep your eyes on all this registration data, Republicans, Democrats, and independents. District 2 would be our most left-leaning district in Iowa?
Yeah, that's fair to say. You know, currently, at least as of the numbers from May from the Secretary of State's office, Democrats outnumber Republicans by about 31,000. And in just percentage terms, yeah, this is our most Democratic-leaning district. And that's been the case over the years. And actually, Democrats have, you know, the number of voters in the district who are registered Democrats has increased by about 1.3 points since even last year. So given the counties that are in the district, particularly Johnson County, this is a Democratic-leaning district. And, you know, if Congressman Lobsack had decided to run again, I think it would have been one of those districts that would probably be a likely Democrat or certainly a lean Democrat. But as Valerie said, with an open seat, you automatically increase the level of competitiveness within that district. And it is important. What Valerie was saying, she makes a really good point there about if it's Marionette Miller-Meeks and Rita Hart, you know, then it's another woman going to Congress to represent Iowa. And that's, you think about the gains that have been made since just prior to 2014, Iowa was one of just two states that never elected a woman as governor or sent a woman to Congress. And then you have Joni Ernst win in 2014. And of course, Governor Reynolds in taking over in 2017 and then winning in 2018. And then obviously with Abby Finkenauer and Cindy Axne. So it's been fascinating to watch the gains that have been made in that regard.
Marionette Miller-Meeks, Dr. Meeks, she's a medical doctor, has had two cracks at this seat before, but then Valerie, she was facing an incumbent, Dave Lobsack, who was running. So she has sort of a reset here, right, as we've been talking about.
Absolutely, and the open seat status provides more of that competitiveness. And what is beneficial to an individual such as Marionette Miller-Meeks is that she has run before. So she has that network. When you lose a race, you still maintain or have the ability to maintain the infrastructure that you've built as a political candidate. So that is certainly a tool within her toolbox that she'll be able to use as a part of this race.
Okay, let's talk briefly, very briefly. Let's talk about the differences this campaign will have compared to previous distances. Brief comments on the fact that this is an online campaign because of COVID, and we're voting online. Chris, how will that shape these races as we close here?
Well, I think it comes down to turnout. I think that's the real question, right? We've seen the numbers coming in from the Iowa Secretary of State's office in terms of, you know, over 400,000 requests for ballots. The Iowa Secretary of State obviously took the initiative to send out those ballot requests to voters. And I think as of today or of yesterday, that over 267,000 of those ballots have been returned. And you look back to the previous primary in a presidential year in 2016, and I think it was about 38,000 ballots were returned by absentee. So just an enormous increase in absentee ballots going out and coming back in. And that raises a lot of questions about what does that mean? You know, and we could get into a longer conversation about does that benefit the Democrat or the Republican parties? I think the evidence is sort of mixed on that at the moment. Okay. So I think that is a real question. You know, what does this mean in terms of turnout? Does it mean more people are voting and who benefits?
Valerie, the final word to you in less than a minute.
And I would say, as we think about mail-in voting and absentee ballots, a critical aspect of this is also voter education. Turnout is going to be key, as Chris said, but making sure that voters have the information and the resources they need to request the absentee ballots, as well as to make sure that they are sent in and received by election officials in a timely manner.
Okay, Valerie Hennings, so good to have you with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Morningside College in Sioux City. Chris Larimer, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Chris, Valerie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'll be off tomorrow. Rick Brewer will be standing in for me. I'll be back on Friday. Thanks for listening.